I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. A new biography of Arthur Erickson has just been published, and I saw it on a bestseller list recently. It's called, aptly enough, Arthur Erickson, An Architect's Life. It's a comprehensive look at the life of Erickson, one of Canada's preeminent architects, who was renowned internationally as well. However, it's in Vancouver, where he was born and where he died, that he, as a reviewer of the book recently said, lives forever. His most notable designs include the Museum of Anthropology and the Kerner Library at the University of British Columbia, Robson Square, and the Provincial Law Courts, as well as the New Portland Hotel, and the soon-to-rise Vancouver's Turn, which will bear the Trump name. Simon Fraser University, which he designed with Jeff Massey in Burnaby, is one of Erickson's best-known works. Elsewhere, there's Roy Thomson Hall in Toronto, the Canadian Chancery in Washington, and Two California Plaza in Los Angeles, among many other edifices. David Stauch is the author of this new book, and he joins me now to talk about it. I'll ask him about how this book came about and the hours of conversations he had with Erickson from 2005 until his death at the age of 84 in 2009. It's a colorful and fascinating life. David Stauch is Professor Emeritus of English at Simon Fraser University, who's written biographies of Ethel Wilson and Sinclair Ross. Arthur Erickson, An Architect's Life, is published by Douglas and McIntyre. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program, David Stauch. Professor Stauch, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. So how well did you know Erickson before you started this book? I mean, were you friends with him?
Not really. I first met him back in 1999, but that was in connection with another project. No, it was some of Arthur Erickson's friends who suggested this project, specifically Mary Buckerfield White. She had been at his 80th birthday party and talking to some of the others, and discovered that there was no one really, you know, collecting up the memories of Arthur in his youth that they had all shared. And so she thought of me because she was Ethel Wilson's niece, and we'd had a good relationship in putting together her aunt's story. And so she phoned me, and I thought, well, that's probably not something that I know very much about. I'm not an architect, nor have I ever studied or taught it, although I know what I like. But I thought, well, I'll think about that. And eventually, as I was approaching retirement at Simon Fraser, I gave it more thought and contacted Arthur. I sent him a letter with the suggestion of his friends, and he wrote back and said, well, we should meet. And we did, and it seemed to be a good conversation that began. This would be 2005, that's 8 years ago, and from that time until he died, at the first part of it, we'd meet every other week, shall we say, for a Saturday or a Sunday afternoon, and that's when I really collected so much of the information, and That got me started.
Yeah. In terms of like, so he knew that a book was to come. Did he give you any sense of what he wanted in the book? I mean, I guess one does if you're telling them stuff, right?
Yes. Well, that was the point of the first meeting. It was kind of a professional sort of thing that he's the one that set it up, and so we talked about what indeed might be there, but he really had the agenda, and he said he wanted his story told, and that I shouldn't need to feel shy about the fact that he was a gay man, and that part of his life, which had never been public in Vancouver, it was time for that to be told, but not to sensationalize it. And I've tried not to. The one thing that he was a little bit he didn't really want me to talk much. He said, why don't you just skip over the bankruptcies? That kind of a curious request. But
yeah.
Of course, that's not something that in a full biography, and that part was composed after his death. And he didn't really set down any, you know, he didn't ask me to sign an agreement.
Sure.
About that. I said it was a professional meeting. It was, in the sense that he had you know, set down some points about what he really wanted discussed. And he really wanted me to do something that was very much on the minds of his friends, which was to recover something of his life, his childhood, his remarkable parents, and what the art scene was like in Vancouver when he was a young man growing up.
So he was born in Vancouver, is that right?
He was. He was born here in 1924.
And what sort of childhood was it?
Well, I suppose everyone's childhood is special, but, you know, standing from the from the outside and looking at his, it was very special. He had unique parents. They were an unusual couple. His father had no legs. He'd lost them in the First World War. His mother was very vibrant, perhaps flamboyant, certainly wholly unconventional kind of woman. They both enjoyed painting as a hobby, so from the outset they nurtured their son's artistic talents. They were all the subject of many stories in Vancouver because they had a lot of friends and were very active people. And then there was the community itself, which created an interesting world for Arthur. That is to say, because his parents had some connections to the very tiny arts community that was here in the 1930s, he too had some connections with that. And most important one is the fact that the Lauren and Bess Harrison, Lauren Harris, the painter, and his wife, had held Saturday evenings at their home where people came to listen to recordings and discuss philosophy. And it was attended by writers and artists and patrons like the Kerners and the Buckerfields and the Growers. So that for Arthur was quite a unique childhood compared to, I think, what most people have.
When did he know that architecture was to be his line of work?
Not that early. That is to say, he at first wanted to be a painter, and he had Lauren Harris's, his encouragement,
mm-hmm.
is a good word. In fact, Lauren Harris was mounting a show at the Vancouver Art Gallery in the early 1940s, and he included some of Arthur's work, and Arthur was still a teenager at the time. And then Arthur went to UBC, and then the war came, and he was conscripted and went overseas. And it was when he came back after being abroad, and of course it was his first taste of travel. He decided what he wanted to really do was study architecture, because he had seen buildings and places on that stint while he was in the Far East, the Middle East and the Far East, and that was to him, you know, something that he wanted to do. Actually, he first thought maybe what he should do was become to go into the diplomatic service,
mm-hmm.
but he found that what he had to study for that just didn't interest him. It involved not only politics but business and so forth. So he opted to do a degree finally at McGill in architecture. So he's in his mid to late 20s, I guess, certainly mid 20s at that point.
In the book, you talk about his grades at Prince of Wales High School, where he went to school. He was, I guess you said something, I can't remember now, no A's, but some B's and C's, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but did he keep those report cards? When I was reading the book, I was interested to know how you found that out.
Well, I got them from the schools.
Oh, I see, okay.
Yeah. Which is always an interesting thing to do.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I had to go through the right channel, they get the permission of the family and things like that before the school would release them, but, that's important, and you know, in some ways it's surprising, but in other ways it's not. The one course of study that really excited him then was of course, in art with a woman named Jessie Font, and she just thrilled him with her ability to be so excited about modern painting, to early 20th century painting. So that sort of was where he, you know, really made a decision for painting. Earlier, it was science. He was particularly interested in zoology and botany. He used to collect creatures, and he would grow things in gardens and grow things in shells on the living room wall, in the living room and so forth. But this woman decided him for art for sure.
So, do you still have an office at SFU?
Do I?
Yeah.
No.
No. But how many years did you work there?
I worked there 40.
Yeah. And what's it like to work on that campus? I've lived in Vancouver my whole life. I've never been to SFU. I went to UBC. So we'd hear stories about, say, the architecture of it and how people would react to it. But as someone who spent a good many years there, 40 years, as you just said, does it impose something on yourself or others that work there?
Well, I was always thrilled with the architecture of that campus long before any idea of a project that I've just been involved in. I guess it gives you I think it does. There is something very thrilling about walking around that campus in good weather.
Yeah.
When the weather's not good, it's just a closed down place like any downtown urban, you know, center on a foggy day. But when it's not, when you can actually, you know, begin to catch sight of those vistas up there that were available to him to sculpt, you might say, as part of his the building and the setting, because you just don't separate the building up there from its setting on Burnaby Mountain. And its terracing of the landscape, as opposed to buildings sitting up tall and high, is what is just so unique and remarkable.
We would hear the stories about, say, that it would depress a lot of people. I mean, is that true?
Well, I guess. But, you know, it wasn't, I don't know if it was the building that would depress. It's the building without its setting can be depressing because it has that austere modernist quality. But, you know, this is the thing that was always so important to Erickson, was that integration of buildings with their setting. And, you know, if you're assigned to do something on Burnaby Mountain, which wasn't his choice of setting, that had been decided before he entered the competition, it's really, I suppose, the only way around that would have been to him to warm up the interiors. That was often that was debated when the building was first opened or was being finished. And in fact, as a result of that debate, some of the others who were involved in the construction of Simon Fraser, such as Zoltan Kiss, tried to do just that, make sure that there were some there was lots of wood paneling on the inside to make it feel less austere and monastic. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, no, that does. Yeah, but for people listening to us, because we're on the radio, I guess, there's a lot of concrete used at SFU, right? And that was, say, the medium that he preferred. Well, what did he say that he thought that it was a marble of our times?
The marble of our time, he said, back in the 1960s.
is SFU the iconic Erickson work then?
Well, for me, I guess the building that I find most thrilling of all, of course, is the Museum of Anthropology, because that's one that, you know, in spite of, I guess, there were some leaks and so forth in the past. And it's still just, you know, I think you'd have to be very insensitive to architecture and setting if you didn't experience something special there. I've taken lots of people there over the years, and that is the one building, I guess, that is so positively received. Simon Fraser, being a complex, is, of course, open to a lot of critical debate because it has lots of different facets.
Yeah, and in terms of his influences or inspirations, going back in his past and his early life, was there something that would be the root of that, perhaps, or the root of his influences and inspirations?
You mean the kind of architecture?
Yeah, sort of what was in the designer's eye, say.
Mm-hmm.
Well, was that the time in Japan?
There's a long history of architecture that basically was his inspiration, because after he left McGill, he had a scholarship that took him to Europe for 2.5 years. Actually, it started and he traveled, and it started actually in the Middle East. And he wound up, in a sense, following through the evolution, the evolving of architecture from the Middle East through Greece and then Rome and on to Western Europe. And in his architecture, he references a lot of those buildings. And then later, about 10 years later, he was in Japan. And that also becomes very important. Japan and Indonesia, specifically Bali, where he experienced the whole... the fact of the landscape being terraced. In this case, of course, it's terraced for agriculture. But it's, to him, it was a beautiful landscape, and all the human building on it, which was also low and flat and in conformity with that kind of terracing. These were things that were, you know, tremendously influential on him.
There's a building that looks, it's in Vancouver, it's terraced, isn't it? With greenery?
Yes, one of his buildings downtown. It's called,
I forget what it's called now, but...
So do I, as soon as you ask.
Yeah, and then it, like...
I think it's referred to as the Evergreen Building.
Yeah.
And it's about 7 stories, and it had greenery on every level.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and then I was at a function recently at the I guess it's called the Waterfall Building.
Yes.
That's just outside Granville Island there. Just a gorgeous place to be in, you know, for just even to walk around and the sort. Was he philosophical in terms of his work lasting forever and the sort?
Well, he lived long enough to see some of his buildings come down. I'm thinking one of the houses that he built in the early 60s, in mid 60s, I guess it was, that he was immensely proud of, was called the Graham House, out in Horseshoe Bay area. And it was bought by an offshore client in the 1980s who lost interest in it, who had perhaps had no interest in it. I've never heard the full details on that story. And it was not kept up. And eventually, before Arthur died, let's say about 2006,
mm-hmm.
it was demolished. And he felt that a lot, in the sense that because it was a building of his that was so highly praised and much photographed, it often, you know, was considered, you know, one of his great domestic pieces, and it came down, and it did make him feel very much how transient even architecture is.
And when they were, I guess they had some renovation of Roy Thompson Hall. He'd written Thompson himself about it.
Yes, renovations bothered him too, if they were not sensitive to what he, you know, some of the main things that he felt were important. One of the wonderful things that has happened with his buildings is one of his, probably his earliest house, you might say, that had any kind of celebration was the one up at Comox, which was sometimes called the Glass House, but it's, in my book I call it the Filbert House, because it was Robert Filbert who commissioned Arthur to do it, and it also fell into rack and ruin, you might say, or at least it was, well, just to put it in the words of Scott Simon, who has photographed so much of Arthur's buildings. It looked like a rundown, a dilapidated motel. So, and he said it looked like the kind of place he definitely didn't want to go into. Well, the a businessman in Courtney has himself personally redone that building, restored it is the word I want to say, because he studied the original from photographs, and with Arthur Erickson's advice and so forth, he managed to redo it in such a way that the building is completely restored. It's just beautiful. So Arthur knew that some might be, you know, saved in that way, while others will be lost.
But part of what we know of Erickson is his image, which he seemed to cultivate just as much as his work. And that, you know, it's a very glamorous sort of life, and with celebrities around and the sort. Do you have a sense of what motivated that, perhaps?
I'll give you Arthur's answer.
Yeah.
He said you have to meet with celebrities and eat in good restaurants and dress well and be seen in public places if you're going to do business in this, if you're going to really do business as a top architect. But he had a taste for it, there's no question. He made a lot of friends, and he made a lot of famous people here in Canada. Of course, he had artist friends like Jack Shadbolt, Gordon Smith, Pierre Trudeau, of course, and the rest of the royals, Charles and Diana. But he also had a lot of, shall we say, New York and Hollywood friends. In New York, Andy Warhol and David Rockefeller. In Hollywood, Shirley MacLaine, Rock Hudson, Katharine Hepburn, Donald Sutherland, Richard Gere. The list goes on and on. People that he met and got to know quite well. And of course, he and his partner, Francisco Carpach, were hosts and entertainers with this crowd. And it was expensive, and so that becomes part of the story, and the story that leads to bankruptcy. So Arthur's story is a glamorous one, but it also has qualities of a Greek tragedy or a morality play, because everything fell apart. And you know, some of his friends got AIDS, and everything seemed to fall away by the 1990s.
And then you have in the book an extract, I guess it's from a diary, I'm not sure, about when Francisco died, mm-hmm. which is just heartbreaking, mm-hmm. the details of that. He had...
because they were together for, well, nearly 40 years.
And
together
so
in a kind of loose partnership, you might say.
And his death, because he I guess Francisco had money problems, and Arthur had on his person, I guess, some money to help him, forgot to give it to him, and then I guess had left town or something like that on a vacation or a trip, and unfortunately Francisco hanged himself. He writes in that extract from his diary that haunted him or that troubled him a great deal. Right up to the end, did it?
Oh, yes, I think so. Mm-hmm. Because he had Francisco's picture with him in the nursing home, and he looked at it a lot. and that was a huge loss for him, no question. Arthur gave Francisco money, but Francisco was very ill, so you know it was tragic in so many ways.
In terms of the friendship with Trudeau, I think I read this in Nancy Southam's book. I can't remember now. Did he supply the roses that Trudeau wore in his lapel?
Well, I've never heard that.
No?
No.
I heard that he...
You may have encouraged him to wear them. But
oh, really? Yeah.
I don't know that he supplied them.
I guess that friendship with Trudeau, that influenced his getting the commission to do the chancery in Washington. Is that right?
Yeah, definitely. Trudeau gave it to him.
Yeah. How much
of... Which, of course, is not... Which is, in many ways, the beginning of a steep decline for Arthur in both his reputation and in the work that he could get in Canada.
The opposition.
The architectural community was just appalled by this.
Was it Crosby that compared him to Albert Speer?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's right.
My pen pal. John Crosby. What was the end like for him? That reading in the book, I guess he had Alzheimer's. Is that right?
Yes, it was getting during the last year. Very, it was pretty obvious in the last year that it was Alzheimer's. He also was suffering with Parkinson's, and the medication for Parkinson's can make people. Can affect their memory and so forth, but it was clearly much more than that. And I think for 3 or 4 years, there was a sense that Arthur's memory is just severely compromised. And although maybe not his memory so much as his everyday ability to remember things, because when I would take him materials that I was collecting for the biography, photographs, things written, and so forth. His memory of the early days was very sharp, and he could pretty much set me straight on things. But I should also mention he did have a way of he had a colorful imagination, as you can well understand. As an artist, he would have, because he was an artist as well as an architect in the sense, or he was an artist. A term which includes architecture, shall we put. And, for example, he gave me a story that was totally inaccurate that I never thought to check about Jeffrey Massey, who was his partner for a time in business. And he told me Jeffrey Massey's parents had divorced and Jeffrey had no contact with his real father, and it was the other way around. It was his mother that was left behind, and he was raised very happily with his biological father, the actor Raymond Massey. So, one had to check Arthur's stories, because the other stories seemed to appeal to him, to Arthur more.
This is such a fascinating book, and inevitably a fascinating life. Thanks for your time today, David, and I hope a lot of people buy the book.
Well, I do too, and I hope that something we didn't really make stress here is that that why Arthur was so important is that his ideas about buildings, the way he rethought the genres of buildings and gave them a whole new democratic. Meanings. So, I want to say that in closing, because that's the real stuff of this book that I think is important. As well as the things we've discussed.
Indeed, the philosophy of it all, and its impact inevitably.
Yeah.
The book is called Arthur Erickson, An Architect's Life. It's from Douglas and McIntyre. Its author, David Stauch, joined me on the line from his home in West Vancouver. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Planta.